This is CliffCentral.com.
Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
I hope you've had a good weekend. Martin and Lawrence in the studio. How's it, Martin, Lawrence?
Good morning.
Howdy, George.
How's it going?
All good.
All good. And what did you get up to this weekend?
I did the most adult thing I could think of. I went appliance shopping.
You went appliance shopping?
Yeah. I had some bad luck. Lost a whole bunch of kitchen appliances due to a power surge and had to go and replace a whole bunch of things. And I thought it would be sort of easy, but then I realized that I haven't gone appliance shopping with a partner for 15 years. and then you realize that there are so many choices of colors and makes and models, and I just wanted a washing machine. I didn't care whether it was made out of stainless steel or if it was purple. I just wanted a washing machine.
I suppose washing machine shopping isn't for the average human being, because how often do you do it? Once in what, 10 years?
To be perfectly honest, the appliances that we replaced are older than my children.
Older than your children. And Martin?
I took a Mercedes Bucky to the hardware store.
You took Mercedes Bucky to a hardware store.
How much cement did you load?
2 pieces of flat bar.
6 months.
Was it your Bucky?
No. No, it's a Mercedes X350 diesel.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Were you testing the Mercedes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you were testing its load bay too.
That's as far as I'm prepared to load it. I'm just scared to hurt this 1 million rand Bucky.
It is a Bucky after all, right?
Yep.
It is a Bucky. Well, let's get into the state of the industry address as we bring you news from the last week. The first story is top car brands in South Africa. So certain cars are popular in Africa, and other cars aren't popular in Africa. And the number one car to top the list, or brand to top the list, is the Toyota.
No doubt. Volkswagen on that list.
Volkswagen is on the list, but it comes in at a position number 9.
And there, ladies and gentlemen, is where customer service reigns supreme.
You think it's customer service?
Absolutely.
Okay, so this is the list of most valuable car brands in the world. And Toyota comes in at $29 billion as topping the list. And Mercedes-Benz second at 23.36, so not far off. BMW is third at $23.3 billion, and Honda fourth at 11.7. So there's a massive gap between third and fourth. I wonder why.
Well, Honda actually, they hold the title of they produce the most petrol engines, or engines in total, in the
Honda
world. Honda, yeah. Lawnmower engines, bike engines,
boat
cars. They make the most engines on the planet.
Do you think that's why they're fourth?
Probably, yes.
Because Ford is fifth. And I would have imagined an American company would have been higher on this list.
Yeah, Ford is struggling a bit at the moment. Globally. Internationally.
Yeah. But what surprised me the most, Martin, was number 7.
Yeah, no.
Number 7 is Tesla at $9 billion, and beats Audi, VW and Porsche to brand value.
Well, Audi, VW and Porsche should actually be listed as one, because they're all part of the same parent company.
Yeah, true, I suppose. But, we're talking about...
So they actually occupy the 9th place, right, with VW.
And then, Martin, you said something about service when it comes to VW.
Yeah, and look, we have... I would say that had they done this maybe 2 or 3 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, VW would have been pretty high up that list. But then there was that whole problem that they had with the cheating scandal and having to buy back all those cars. I actually saw a video of an abandoned military airbase in Colorado. The entire runway, the entire military airbase, is basically one giant parking lot full of VWs that they had to purchase back from the customers.
Wow.
I saw that image. I think it's 60,000 cars standing in one place.
Yeah.
On
they can't move them. So we're going to be getting an influx of diesel VW cars in the next year or so.
See, the other thing is now also to make amends for Dieselgate, Volkswagen has had to pay out a huge amount in fines. I have no idea where they're standing at the moment.
Billions but it's of euros,
the billions of dollars or billions of euros. And they have to invest heavily because they've now made the commitment towards electric vehicles.
Well, let's see. Maybe this list will change over time. But the next story is there. The next story is South Africa's top 50 selling cars for June. Now, everybody knows that the new car sales are under some serious pressure, shrinking by 1.6% in June 2019 over June 2018, with 46,663 units sold. But light commercial vehicles seems to be bucking the trend with a 1.2% growth to 14,495 units.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. Exactly. But this positive news was offset by a 3.2% decline in the passenger car market and saw sales of 28,885 units. So what is happening in the car industry? Because passenger vehicle sales seem to be sliding further and further. Commercial vehicle sales seem to be okay or growing marginally.
Businesses can buy vehicles. Consumers are being a little bit more reserved with their spending.
Yeah.
They're not prepared to lay out on a new car just because it's a new car. If the car breaks or have a serious issue, then they will go and trade it in, or if they are forced to trade it in, they will do that. But most consumers are now sitting on their hands going, well, I'm just going to wait this one out to see what happens with the economy.
Well, a wait-and-see approach, right? So we saw this in 2008, 2009 as well. Consumers just wait to see what happens.
It's going to bounce back. We just don't know
where. Exactly. I'm always on the positive side of this, in that when new vehicles are under pressure, used vehicles are buoyant because we don't have transport infrastructure. And because we don't have transport infrastructure in South Africa, people have to drive. Mm. If they have to drive and they're under economic pressure, they just downgrade or they go for a second-hand car.
It's actually funny. I was listening to the radio this morning on the way in, and the question was what is the one thing that people can't live without in their cars? And the guy that phoned in, he said, well, I just climbed out of a BMW 320i and I'm now driving a Renault Quid.
So I'm basically
everything
I'm missing everything.
So basically that's telling you what guys are trading in expensive cars and getting just a simple mode of transportation,
being practical, using a car for its purpose. It's functional.
It's something I get a lot on Ask Auto Trader as well, where people want to try down from a larger, more expensive car to a cheaper one. But then
what is the number one question?
No. It's everything from a Nissan X-Trail down to BMWs.
No. What's the top question? Which car should I trade for?
No. The main question in that regard is, how much money will I lose if I get rid of this expensive car now?
Okay. So it comes down to value.
Yes.
What all of them are trying to do is trade in the vehicle, take the extra to
put it into another car.
Or reduce their monthly payments.
Do you think valuation on a private car is becoming more important?
Oh, yes.
How much can I sell this car for?
I would actually be very interested to see what our click rate is like on the valuation tool on site that tells you, okay, how much is the car worth? Because I know I've used it a few times when people from friends and family have asked me, how much do you think my car is worth? And then I have to play a guessing game. Like, okay, just give me a second. I'm going to
Do some calculations. And you look busy on your cell phone for a bit.
It's worth about 129K.
Well, there's a whole bunch of factors into valuation, and maybe we can have a segment dedicated to what cars are worth in the country, second-hand cars particularly, in a future show. But topping that list of June 2019 sales, Toyota Hilux, surprise, surprise.
South Africa's national car.
They should put it
on a coin. Really, they should mint it on the new 5 rand coin.
Or at least on a postage stamp.
Then coming in close second, a VW Polo Vivo, surprise, surprise. Then the Ford Ranger sold 2,000 vehicles and VW Polo 1,887, with the Nissan NP200 at 1,709.
Which accounts for your commercial vehicles.
And then number 7 and 8 are another two Toyotas.
Yep.
And then number 12 is another Toyota. And 15 and 16 is another Toyota. And number 21 is another Toyota. And number 23 is a Toyota Yaris. I don't know if there's any more Toyotas on this list.
You wonder why Toyota is worth so much globally.
Number 44, Toyota Rush. And number 48 and 49, Toyota CHR and the Toyota Corolla being 49th.
How the mighty have fallen.
Wow. That's incredible. So that is the top 50 selling cars in June 2019. If you want to know more about that, tweet us. But another story that seems to be quite topical at the moment is South African car parts. Now, we know that in the world of vehicles, new vehicles and second-hand vehicles, price transparency has become a big thing. The more the internet has proliferated, so prices have become more and more transparent across the board. The consumers have access to what cars are worth, what they're selling for, what they can trade them for, etc. And it seems that the spotlight is now on South African car parts.
Because, let's be honest, the cost of a headlight or a Polo versus the cost of a headlight on an Audi Q8.
Oh.
Galaxies apart. It's the same thing. It's glass,
you're not
plastic.
You're not talking about the cost to manufacture. You're talking about the cost to the consumer.
Cost to the consumer. A headlight for a VW Polo is about 850 rand.
Yeah, yeah.
And about the headlight for an Audi.
Headlight for an Audi Q8, the last time I checked, was about 38,000.
Yeah. Holy moly.
It's the same plastic and glass and glassware. How do you justify that kind of a price difference? I mean, it's a 12,000% increase.
Mm. Well, maybe, a Durban-based journalist, Malcolm Kinsey, and maybe we can try and get him into the studio on a call at some point, has been keeping up to date with spare parts in the industry.
Yeah, the monthly Kinsey report.
Yes, the monthly Kinsey report. And, it turns out that lack of a better word, is price inflation of parts seems to have gone through the roof. The Datsun Go, for instance, has gone from a basket of parts costing 63,310 rand, with the Renault Kwid and the Ford Figo following in second and third place with a basket of parts cost of 66,707 and 67,000 rand for a basket. Now you ask yourself, if a basket of for the Datsun Go, this is a sampled basket of parts, was going for 44,372 in 2017 and now is going for 63,310 rand in 2019, what percentage increase is that? And sure. Why?
You're asking me to do maths on a Monday morning.
No, I mean, it's just big.
It's massive.
It's like almost 20,000 rand. That's 50%,
so
right?
It's almost 50%.
It's almost 50%. Yeah. Now, is that as a result of import costs?
Most likely.
Because Datsun Go.
Yeah.
Not locally made.
Not locally manufactured.
So all the parts are imported as well.
Okay. So does it then make sense to buy a Toyota because... are Toyotas suffering less from parts of price inflation?
It's exactly why our list of the top best-selling cars is populated by Toyotas, because you can walk into any spare shop
and buy
automotive
Toyota
spares.
Parts.
You can, at the street corner down the road, you can even buy them at a bloody spaza shop if you wanted to. I need a water pump for a Toyota Hiace. Bam, the Oak's got one in the back. You cannot. I don't know how many times I've experienced this, because I also do a lot of work on vehicles and stuff. You go to a spare shop and you ask them, look, I need a lower control arm for a Toyota or let's say a Jeep Cherokee.
Yeah.
And the guy's going to look at you like you're speaking German and tell you, sorry, agents only.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the three words you do not want to hear. When
that's
somebody
true.
Says, sorry, agents only, it means take out your checkbook because you're about to be rogered. It's the honest truth, because if you're going into the spares section at a dealership, they see you coming through the glass and they're like, oh yeah, here it comes.
Yeah, I don't know if it's as much that as maybe the input costs in those parts. I don't for a second believe dealerships are out to get people. Yes,
they just know
there's ones out there, but I don't believe for a second that by and large dealerships are out to get people. It is the input cost.
They carry it over to the consumer.
They carry, and that's normal business practice, right?
And that's when we know.
Yes. So, I mean, I'd love to hear more about this parts inflation in the future. But the next story is pretty interesting, and that is I wasn't entirely aware that once your car's insurance claim got approved, that it could be then afterwards not paid. to the panel beater. So panel beaters have been complaining that they battle to get the money out of the insurer, they battle to get the insurer to honor the claim, and then what happens is you get the pre-approval, you have an accident, you take your car to the panel beater, your car gets fixed before the panel beater actually gets paid, and then you take your car afterwards and they have to fight for the money.
That just sucks.
Yeah. It does suck. So anyway, so the motor body repairers got the green light to implement a pay before release scenario, which means that if you take your car to the panel beater now, they don't have to give you your car back until such time as they get paid, which I think is fair, don't you?
It puts a little bit of the onus on the consumer to now chase their insurance company. Excuse me, I want my car back. They won't give me my car back because you haven't paid them yet. Stop giving them their money so I get my car.
But you also end up with the situation of insurance companies battling amongst each other. And I've had a case in my own experience where 2 years after the accident, the insurance company still hadn't decided who was actually the cause of this accident. So
what does that got to do with paying? Because my belief is that your insurance company will pay and then they'll fight the case against the other insurance company.
That should happen, yes. But it often doesn't.
Yeah.
I think we need to get somebody from an insurance company in and find that exactly.
That's not a bad
the
idea.
Inner workings.
But the interesting thing is this pay before release principle has been in order, it's been in practice in the normal mechanical repair side of things. Forever.
Yes.
No money, no car, whoever you are.
But remember, insurers aren't paying for that, right?
No, the consumers not always.
So that's, mostly. I think that's the big thing here. So that's been the news in general for the week. Let's get into what's happening on the grid. So in motorsport news, the F1 results, which usually is brought to us by one Dile Sishe, we're going to dial him in and see what he has to say about Verstappen's win. If you give us a second, we'll dial him in and see if he can get onto the line. Well, one Dile is our resident Formula One expert. And let's see if one dealer's there. One dealer.
Hi, George. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. Thanks for dialing me in.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome. So Verstappen won the last F1 race in Austria, and he took the lead not very far from the end, and it was for me it was one of the most exciting races that we had ever experienced this year. What was your take on what happened?
No, most definitely. I think you just hit it like the nail right on the head. So for me, this was easily the most exciting race for the season. This season has been completely riddled by lots of drama and lots of things happening in outside of the track. So for us to kind of see two potential F1, greats go neck to neck, wheel to wheel on the track, that's of Ferrari's Charles Leclerc and Max was completely, unbelievable and just spectacle to see.
Well, I mean, that last overtaking maneuver where Verstappen actually got the lead was a bit of controversy around it. And how did you read the stewards' result in the end?
So just to give some context, so what happened is that obviously Max was He started really badly in the race, and then he fought about 50 laps to sort of make his way back to the front of the grid. He fought two Mercedes Benzes, he fought two world champions, previous world champions, that being Lewis Hamilton and Vettel. And then in order to clinch the win, he had to go and fight another Ferrari, that of Charles Leclerc, and he was doing exceptionally well throughout the entire race. And what then happened is he was forced to sort of use any sort of opportunity he can take in order to overtake him, which resulted in the two of them sort of touching and Charles losing his lead. The stewards would then say, this is, we need to investigate this because, of everything that's happened previously.
The stewards have got involved in so many things over the last couple of races that, I'm wondering if it's taking the sport too far. Let's take a quick listen to the actual commentating from F1 on this overtake by Verstappen on Leclerc. Well, technology never fails to impress. So while we're waiting for that to come up, you know, that overtake was controversial because Verstappen pushed Leclerc off the track. All four wheels were off the track. Did you see it that way too?
Yeah, I did see it that way. I really did. But at the same time, this is racing. You know, this is, you know, what the sport's all about. This is what the fans want to see. I think as long as it's done in a respectful way and it's not to necessarily push a driver entirely off and ruin their race,
yeah,
you need to take that into consideration. I think that's what the stewards did here, and they realized that by not taking that into consideration, you might completely change what the sport meant, its history, and you know, where it's going, you know, in the future. These cars are getting faster, they're getting wider. It's not, you're not always going to be able to play by the rules and by the formula that's been given. You know, you need to sometimes have leeway for what drivers are doing, and you know, that's what they do best, and that's what the people want
to
see.
Well, motorsport is a little bit of, you know, dog eat dog sort of scenario. You're there to race, you're not there to be nice. Exactly. You know, and maybe the stewards getting involved and F1 getting involved is just making it a bit of a procession instead of allowing teams to race and develop technology as far as they possibly can.
Yeah, of course, you know, you can't, you know, take the rules out completely, or else we'll just be, you know, free for all. But there needs to be some sort of parameters where, you know, racing incidents are exactly seen for exactly that and nothing more.
Yeah.
I think this was a very great example of that. You know, we go back to I think it was in Melbourne where with Hamilton and Vettel, and it's the same thing, you know, and they see what's happening when they don't take that into consideration.
Well, let's get on to Hamilton in a second, but from the stewards, and I can't get this this video to play, but so if I describe it, explaining the decision, the steward said that car 33 Verstappen sought to overtake car 16 Leclerc at turn 3 on lap 69 by outbreaking car 16, which you know, Verstappen did quite well in my opinion. When doing so, car 33 Verstappen alongside Leclerc on the entry of the corner and was in full control of the car while attempting to overtake Leclerc. However, both car 33 and car 16 proceeded to negotiate the corner alongside each other, but there was clearly insufficient space for both cars. Shortly after the on the late apex, while exiting the corner, there was contact between the two cars. And I suppose that's what prompted the incident itself. In totality of circumstances, the steward said, we did not consider that either driver was wholly or predominantly to blame for the incident. We consider it a racing incident. Now, this racing incident seems to be an undefined thing. Some things are racing incidents, some things are not. But in this instance, it was a racing incident.
And that's the problem. They need to define what these parameters are, because this is not the last time you're going to see this. This season especially, the cars are wider, they're faster, and you're really seeing how that, you know, impacts how the course of the race is going to be.
Yeah.
These parameters definitely need to be understood. It shouldn't be a gray line. You know, this is, lots of money is invested in these races by the teams and by the investors. And it's important that for fans as well, for the sake of the fans watching the sport, that we know what it is. And it's not just a decision made by three men in the back of a room.
Well, sometimes it feels like just three men in the back of a room making a decision, because, you know, are they ex-racing drivers? Do they really understand what it's like to be in an F1 car before they take these crucial decisions that, you know, either create a bad taste in the viewer's mouth or, you know, change the results for the future of the F1 championship?
And that's the thing. I've seen a few previous drivers who used to be on the grid actually saying that they would love to be stewards because, you know, it added new elements of experience in terms of knowing what it means to race and what it means to be wheel-to-wheel with a, you know, car moving at 300 k's an hour.
Bring on F1 drivers as stewards. That's what I say. Bring on F1 drivers. And then tell us a little bit about the F1 power rankings. How does it work and who's on top?
So the power rankings, they take into consideration not just essentially who's got the, you know, the most powerful car on the grid at the time of the race, but rather the performance or the individual performance of the driver on the day. So every single time, it moves up and down. You know, you may win the race, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be at the top of the power ranking. This race we saw that who's this now? Max Verstappen's
on top. Yeah,
is at the very top of the ranking.
So this is a race by race account. So it's not a cumulative power ranking. It's decided on a race by race basis.
Precisely. Precisely. Okay. And I think Max deserves the number one spot. I mean, he started in second, but then he went back to eighth, and then he fought all the way back up. It was insane. I think he really deserves that position. I don't think anybody else fought as hard as he did to claim his position. And then in second place, we have Lewis Hamilton, who fell down one position.
So what's happening to your man, Lewis Hamilton?
Please, George, don't you're hurting my feelings.
What's happening to Vettel?
Well, no, Vettel, I don't know. I think he's suffering, to be honest with you. I think he's suffering from too much emotion again, and that we know. But Hamilton is usually so bloody focused. He doesn't miss a beat. I suppose you could take a page out of the way Bottas has performed, which is not great either. So maybe the focus is there and their car's just not good enough.
I think that's exactly it. But
you would say that, right?
I'm going to say there's some serious issues, overheating issues in Austria. Yeah. It's not an excuse, but that played a huge role in how Mercedes did in Austria. I think Hamilton ultimately came fifth, and Bottas came third. So you could see that despite the skill, and they fought really hard, the car was just not performing the way it should be.
Well, let's take a quick listen at Max Verstappen's reaction to the steward's decision that he actually won the Austrian Grand Prix. And hopefully we don't have any technical issues. Take a listen.
Did you ever believe any different after that race you had today?
The last 3 hours have been really stressful, but I think they made the right decision, also for the sport. So, I'm very happy about it, of course.
Has that got to be the highlight, the best race you've done?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it was just very exciting and we were pushing really hard, so.
Well, listen, enjoy your night. You deserve it. It was a great drive.
Thank you, mate.
So, in Verkrashen style, I think he deserved that win. He didn't crash into anybody, on purpose. And he was still on the track at the end. So I think he really deserved that win. Unlucky for Hamilton. I still think he's the formidable and most focused person on that track. I still support Ferrari. Leclerc's got some experience to gain before he can keep people behind him. Vettel is still suffering from emotional issues.
Yeah, that is true. But we're going to Silverstone. I think it's next week. In what actually might be the last race, at least in the near future, at Silverstone.
Okay.
Which is the home track for Hamilton. So,
well, thanks, Wandile. Thanks for joining us, and I look forward to the next race and your commentary on it.
Looking forward to it as well. Thanks, George.
Cheers. Have a good day. Well, there we have it. Wandile Sishe, our resident Formula One expert. And then lastly in motorsport, we very closely follow Tasman Pepper, who is our South African female racer in the W Series that has been introduced in 2019. And just to keep you up to date with the rankings, and the result after 36 laps in the last race, Tasman Pepper came eighth, and there was a gap between Marta Garcia and Tasman Pepper of 25.7 seconds. She finished the race in eighth place. And on the driver standings, Jamie Chadwick leads the driver standings with Tasman Pepper at 22 points in eighth position. Jamie Chadwick having 83 points at this point in the W Series. And we'll continue to follow the W Series into the future and see how well our resident South African female racing driver does. But our next segment is Auto Talk. So let's get right into that. And in Auto Talk, we have Lawrence, who is going to review for us the Ford Raptor.
Yes. So it definitely doesn't sound like that.
You're unimpressed.
I was pretty excited to get my hands on the Raptor. There was a lot of, there has been a lot said about its off-road prowess, and I will freely admit that this thing is absolutely amazing off-road.
I decided
that everybody had been focusing on the off-road capabilities of the vehicle. The suspension system that soaks up the bumps, and you can ramp the thing off of ledges and stuff. It's the pictures that you'll see floating around social will tell you just what this thing's capable of. I decided to see what it would be like for the average South African boot that buys this thing to drive it around town every day. So I took a road trip. I drove from Johannesburg to Durban via the Golden Gate National Park, Clarence.
I love that route. I absolutely love that route.
Yeah, it was a really, really pleasant trip. Now, when they dropped the car off, it arrived in all its glory. Extra wide sheet metal, giant 30-inch knobbly tires. The thing just looks like it drove through an aftermarket shop and everything stuck to it.
I was about to say, that sounds much like almost any Ranger in Pretoria.
And that's the problem. If you were not an enthusiast and did not fully value what the Raptor is, it will look exactly the same as every other aftermarket Raptor kit that you can buy from.
But what's wrong with that? I mean, it's just a body kit, right?
What's wrong with it is a 3.2 Wildtrak costs 600,000 rand. The Raptor's 803.
Sure.
Very, very difficult to justify the price.
And is it just body kit?
It's not a body kit. It's actual sheet metal. This thing is like almost a foot wider than your standard Ranger. It's wide. It just fit in my garage. And when I saw these giant 30-inch knobby tires, I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what have I gotten myself into? I'm about to do 2,800 kilometers. And for anybody who has driven a double cab will know what a terrible road noise those giant knobby tires make when you're driving.
I drove a Jeep Wrangler for a weekend because Jeep was trying to convince me to take on one of their Wranglers, and it had some of these tires on it.
And it's horrible.
It's the road noise is unbelievable.
And that surprised me.
It wasn't the Jeep, it was the tires.
Not a sound. I don't know what Ford has done to isolate the interior, the NVH levels of this vehicle, because it was dead quiet.
No, you got to take that seriously, because some of these tires can make some serious
noise.
And I was
genuinely
noise.
Thinking that I'm going to be tortured for 2,800 kilometers, but not. It was absolutely quiet.
It's called active noise control.
Active Ford, noise control.
Yeah.
What, through the speaker system?
Yeah, the Ford actually, they introduced it on the Everest.
Yeah?
They play back a frequency that kills the...
Yeah, so it literally listens to the noise
like
inside
headphones.
The cabin.
Yeah.
And then it plays down, and then it plays through the speakers the inverse frequency to cancel out the noise.
But even so, it was the and then... Just to offset what I'm saying, I went to Botswana.
No, but just hold on a second. Does this Ford have this technology?
Yes, they all do now. So I went to Botswana for 3 days.
You know what they're doing? Sorry, Martin Lawrence. You know what they're doing? They're getting us used to the electric cars.
Yep.
Because if they're going to cancel out all the noise in the car, eventually we're going to be so used to the silence, electric cars are going to come. It's going to be a smooth transition, right?
Until you open the window and you hear from a diesel in front.
So I spent 3 days in Botswana with Ford last week. I had the Raptor the week before.
Yeah.
And we were driving the new Everest, and we drove it off-road. And the Everest also has this technology in. But now, the Raptor is the big hoo-ha about it is it comes with Ford's new 2-liter bi-turbo diesel engine mated to a 10-speed transmission. And in the Raptor, it left me cold because it, to be perfectly honest, it felt gutless. I was like, man, they need to fit a 3.2 petrol to this thing. There's no way that this people are going to buy this thing. It's underpowered.
Yeah.
And then I drove the Everest with the same power kit. And it was like chalk and cheese. I don't know how. And the only thing I can put it down to is those giant wheels and tires that just completely screwed up the gearing on the Raptor.
Yeah.
Because it feels underpowered. It's lazy off the line. But once you get up to speed,
did you have a look at the size of the tire? Is it different to the standard tire that comes on the Ford?
Yes, because I was having a chat with Neil Hill, which is the marketing GM of Ford. The tires for the Raptor were specifically designed for the Raptor. So they are, you know, they've
in relation to the gearbox ratio. Because I mean, for those who don't you know, don't follow exactly what Lawrence is saying, you know, he's technically proficient at understanding these things. But if you put a bigger tire, that circumference is bigger on any vehicle, you mess up the standard design that car was made to operate with its gearbox. Yeah. And you change effectively change the gear ratios.
Yes,
because the rev range of the car is different because one revolution of the wheel travels further or shorter depending on whether the tire is bigger or smaller. Yes. So it changes the speed at which you change gears. It changes a whole lot of things.
And that's the thing. I really like the 10-speed transmission that's in Ford's new kit, because this is the same engine and combo that they're putting in the new Ranger.
Yeah.
They're putting it in the Everest, and it's in the Raptor as well. And I haven't had a chance to drive the Wildtrak yet, but if it's anywhere the way it is in the Everest, the engineers really need to take the Raptor back and go and have a look at what's going on there. Because, like I said, if you were in a standard 2.2 Ranger and a Raptor pulled up next to the robots, you're going to smoke him off the line.
Yeah, but is it a racing car? Or is it an off-road?
Yes, it is. It's an off-road racing car. And if you are the kind of person who is prepared to spend 803,000 Rand on a vehicle that you can go and thrash in the desert and jump over sheep and stuff, it's going to be perfect. But if you're going to buy this vehicle to drive it around town every day to look like a boot, you are going to be sorely disappointed.
Well, unless you want to drive slowly, right?
You might as well buy the Wildtrak and kit it out with all the stuff from your local accessory shop.
Well, I'll give you feedback on the Wildtrak, because I see it's scheduled for a road test with me for early in August.
It'll be a good comparison side by side. Maybe putting a table together, you know, Ford Wildtrak and Ford Raptor.
Look, the trip was amazing. I really enjoyed the drive. It was awesomely comfortable. But don't try and maneuver it in a parking lot in a busy mall, because it has a turning circle of a cruise ship. And be prepared for every bloke and his buddies to come up to you and ask you, hey, Boot, is that the new Ranger? Because, yes, we've never seen one of these in the wild before. You get the wrong kind of attention. But all in all, I think
maybe that's the kind of attention they want.
Yeah. If you really are an enthusiast and you want to have one of these, because they are limited numbers, they're not going to be around forever. If you really want one of these, you're not going to go wrong, because want it because you're an enthusiast.
Let's be honest.
But if you're just buying it for the looks and the name.
The Wildtrak, the Raptor, a lot of guys would drive it for the way it looks.
And that's exactly it.
Not necessarily the way it drives. It's, you know, we live in the sad world, unfortunately, of, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and perception and all that stuff. So this would be one of those examples. If someone wants to drive it and they're happy to, you know, to take on the limited power that it has because of the increased size in tires, well, you know what?
I was pretty lucky, because I got one of the ones that didn't have the garish sticker pack on it. Mine was just plain blue. There are other ones floating around that have got this huge camouflage pattern running across the side and down the doors.
It has to have that. I mean, what's a brodozer without some spray?
A brodozer.
That's what they called. Without some spray on mud. Come on.
I've learned two things today. A brodozer.
Well, yeah, that's what the Yanks call them. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. It fared well. It, like I said, left me cold. I want to recommend it on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm like, well.
Is it just the lack of power?
It's the lack of power, and it was what was putting me off about it until I drove the Everest, and then I realized it's not the lack of power, because there's plenty of power there. There's something in the design and the way it's been put together that sort of, like I said, you'd be better off in a 2.2 Ranger.
Tell me, fuel consumption?
I average 10.5, 127 k's an hour.
With those big knobblies, that's not bad.
That's not bad at all.
That's about what the old 3.2 did.
Manufacturer claims 8.5.
Yeah, right.
But that's never true, right? Especially in Gauteng.
So 10.5, long-distance freeway driving, 127. Probably my favorite and it's a must-have nowadays, Apple CarPlay.
Yeah.
That made that journey just that much better.
Sync 3 is a good one.
Well, it's actually, I spoke to Dale from Ford, it's actually Sync 3.3.
Oh.
It's a new Sync 3.
Okay.
And it's fitted to all of the new, it'll be in the Wildtrak, the Everest, and the Raptor.
Okay.
And so if you've got Sync 3.0, can you upgrade to Sync 3.3?
I don't know. I think it's basically just they've added on a few extra menus and options.
Yeah, but that's software, right? So if the hardware can handle it, you know.
The funny thing, though,
let's find out.
I was, whenever I got near a place that had Wi-Fi, the car would ask me to connect to the Wi-Fi networks. Because it wanted to update to the latest software.
There you've got connected cars of the future.
And a little bit frustrating because you have to keep telling it no, not connect.
There's got to be something in the menu that that stops it from doing it.
But absolutely, super, very, very comfortable, quiet, and yeah, I just hope that they might consider putting a bigger power plant.
What we want is a 2.7 V6 EcoBoost petrol, man.
No, I want a 5-litre Coyote from a Mustang.
Come on, it's old school.
Put electric motors on it. And on, on that note, so if you want to sell your car in different parts of South Africa, can you get a different price for the same car? And each week that we do this podcast, I'm gonna bring you some best buy tips or best sell tips, and it turns out that you can definitely get a different price depending on where you sell your car. For instance, if you're trying to sell a VW Polo GTI in Mpumalanga, and you thought it was futile, you might be surprised to learn that the GTI sold in this province actually yielded higher prices than anywhere else in South Africa. VW Polo GTI in Mpumalanga. So you can sell a VW GTI in Mpumalanga for a higher price than you can anywhere else. And this is because, you know, Auto Trader now sits on one of the cleanest, formidable databases in South Africa, and we can tell these things because of the amount of demand and supply data that we sit on. And then across South Africa, believe it or not, a silver Polo GTI sells the quickest. A silver Polo GTI, followed by blue, black, and then white.
Yeah, nobody likes a white Polo.
Hey, I would have thought white would
red?
Have been.
I would have thought red. Where's red? Red for the Polo GTI looks splendid.
So that's the speed at which they sell, but the color that sells for the highest price across the entire South Africa is a black Polo GTI.
Yeah, makes you look like Knight Rider.
So our database at autotrader.co.za reveals that on average, black sells for as much as 100,000 Rand more than other colors.
In other words, if you have a black Polo GTI, you can sell it for more. But so if you want a bargain, you're going to
buy it for more. So don't complain when you see a black one for a certain price and you're trying to compare that black one to a white one. And if you're in Mpumalanga, it's going to be different anyway.
So who came up with the white cars sell the quickest, get you the best price?
Well, they are on the list of quickest, huh?
So, because that was always something that I was led to believe for years, is that you buy a white car because it will sell quick and you'll get the best price for it, because nobody buys metallic cars because the paintwork scratches. Nobody buys black cars because you can see every single speck of dirt and scratch and nick in it.
Well, that's the difference between data and gut feel. Emotion in real life. And the data shows us that silver Polo GTIs sell the quickest and black Polo GTIs sell for the highest price. So there you got some data.
That's very, very interesting.
But it doesn't end there. If you're wanting to sell a GTI with a sunroof, then again, head to Limpopo, because you can expect to sell it twice as fast than in KZN in the Western Cape.
My word.
Amazing
There's
stuff.
There's no
eh?
Logic behind this. We can't explain
it. Well, it's not logic. It's data. It's just because someone's feeling an emotion about where a car sells, how fast it sells, and what features sell is based on their own experience, whereas the data shows different. And these things can change, and we see them change from time to time. So our preconceived notions of where and when to buy or sell vehicles, along with colors, options, and features, can't trump the comprehensive database that autotrader.co.za sits on, because these demand and supply numbers show quite clearly consumer appetite and supply.
I would love to be able to get into that program because I got some crazy search results that I want to throw at it.
So this all because we've reinvented our web search functionality, and if you go onto autotrader.co.za, you'll be able to find the car that you're looking for fast as lightning, because the database is that quick and that intuitive. So go and have a look, and you go and come and tell us, what do you think of the new search feature? Our next segment is talking. Oh no, our next segment is talking tech. So where we get into what can your car do? So car owners have problems with driver assist gizmos, and I don't know how many driver assist gizmos you guys have got in your cars.
My cruise own control. Car, nothing.
I have cruise control.
I have ABS.
Well, no, that's a safety feature. We're talking about driver assistance programs. Look, two of the cars that I've driven in the past year and a half that have got driver assist systems that I believe should be put into every single car. It's Mercedes-Benz BMW.
Yeah.
That has a comprehensive driver assistance package, which basically consists of adaptive cruise control,
lane keeping assist,
lane departure warning, pre-collision alert. I think Volvo has it as well.
Rear cross traffic alert and blind spot monitoring.
And these are not just safety systems. These are things that will actually help you drive your car.
Well, I mean, let's define driver assist for a second. I mean, a steering wheel is driver assist.
No. It's a primary control. Actually power steering.
Aha. Okay. So now we're getting to more of a definition before we get into what problems exist when it comes to driver assist. Okay. So the required, what did you call them? Primary
controls.
Primary controls.
Steering wheel, pedals,
gear lever, all those things. Those are primary controls. So anything that assists those primary controls or the driver is driver assist, which kind of like is anything technology related nowadays. Well, so power steering is not tech, right? It's
no.
Or should I say not electronic tech? It's mechanical or pneumatic or hydraulic.
Well, you get electric power steering.
You get electric power steering.
Which is tied into the systems, because a lot of your lane departure warning will actually send vibrations to the steering wheel to tell you, hey, you're drifting out of your lane.
Or actually steer the car by itself.
Steer the car by itself. And how much drive-by, or should I say steer-by-wire, exists in cars today?
There's only one car that I know of that's fully steer-by-wire. That's the Infiniti Q50.
Okay, the Infiniti Q50, where the car is not, the steering wheel is not physically connected to the wheels.
Yeah, it's connected to sensors and actuators, and then other actuators.
I wonder if the Infiniti drivers know this.
Let's not go there. Yeah.
Anyway, so now that we've put that into context, car owners have problems with driver assist gizmos. And in Detroit, car companies continue to fix buggy touchscreen infotainment systems. And a survey of new vehicle buyers found that there's a different technology posing problems. Driver assist systems such as automatic emergency braking. And then J.D. Power puts out a survey on a regular basis to ask consumers what sorts of faults are being reported. And it turns out that the Genesis, Hyundai's luxury brand, had only 63 problems per 100 vehicles. Now you might find, 63 problems per 100 vehicles might sound a lot. But if you look at the problems that were reported, in 2014, you'll find that there were 116 problems reported per 100 vehicles. So if it's come down to 63 problems per 100 vehicles, and we've got all of this technology in these cars now, is this just consumers making a noise about the gizmos that are in their cars? But then the second question is there more risk than what there was in the past? Because in the past, you would have your steering wheel connected to the wheels. So if there was a problem, the mechanics would probably go a little bit funny, and then you could control the car. Whereas if the software goes funny, what happens? Is it more risky?
You know, this is
a
conversation we've had many, many times in the past. Goes hand in hand with, are the electronic gizmos making us worse drivers?
Yep. Maybe.
We all learned to drive on cars that didn't have ABS. Your steering wheel is connected directly to the front wheels by mechanical linkages. It's a completely different... I don't know.
It was a different world. I think many of these problems, as they are called, don't really relate to actual malfunctions in the system. It relates to the car's buyers and the owners not understanding how they work and what they're supposed
exactly.
to do.
Exactly. So now that's what JD Power goes on to say, is that a lot of the reported faults is actually driver training.
Yeah.
That's, you know, because these things are becoming more and more sophisticated. And as humans, do we really understand them? Do we really understand how they work, what they're there for, what they're designed to do? And if we move on to the next piece of talking tech, which is the autopilot system not being safe.
Well, I think the problem's right there in the name.
Yeah.
Autopilot. Yep. Yes, exactly.
They are not autopilot systems. They are driver assistance and systems.
In Tesla's case, the car's operating manual clearly says that the driver should not take their hands off the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And now in surveying, questioning 2,000 people, 21% to the 33% of study respondents thought that it would be safe for the drivers to take their hands off the steering wheel when using driver assist systems.
Yeah, 20% or more thought it would be safe to talk on the phone. Smaller percentage thought texting, watching a video, or taking a nap would be safe. Oh, come on.
No, you know, and that's
was this in America by any chance?
Yeah, of course it was in America. It always happens in America.
And that's in spite of the car's operating manual saying you have to keep your hands on the wheels and your attention on the road at all times.
Those three cars that I spoke about earlier that had the driver assistance packages in them, you are required, you can take your hands off the steering wheel for about 40 seconds before the car tells you, gives you a yellow warning, a green warning, a yellow warning, and then the red warning, and then the system deactivates.
Yeah.
And then what? The car just parks itself?
Basically. No, you have to grab the steering wheel because it's just switched off, because you are supposed to keep at minimum one hand, and it has sensors in the steering wheel. Are you holding the steering wheel?
Some of these cars are actually clever enough to, if you don't put your hands on the steering wheel, it'll start scanning for a safe place to pull over.
Which is a brilliant idea.
So it will navigate its way through traffic.
Maybe car makers should make the car do that sooner rather than later. Yeah. Give you a maximum of, what, how long? 3 seconds?
Well, Mercedes gives us 30 seconds, as I recall.
Yes.
BMW, 30, that's a lot. Yeah. You can have an accident in 30 seconds.
Yeah, you
can
actually.
Yeah.
Volvo gives you 15 and BMW gives you 5.
Well, there we go.
And if you take your hands off the wheel...
Yeah, that being said, every single person that has been killed in an auto-driving car, that's in brackets, has been doing something stupid like sleeping or texting or reading a book.
Or watching a movie.
What, in these autopilot cases?
Yes. Mm.
Well, there's been controversy around every single one of these accidents and, around what the driver was actually doing at the time of the accident.
Sleeping, reading a book, texting.
You can't read a book. You can't watch a movie. No. You can't go and have lunch while your autopilot is on. That's not what the current autopilot is designed to do.
So maybe the problem is then in the name.
Damn it,
and
people.
The auto manufacturers need to, like we have
it's
so much.
It's in the freaking manual.
Yeah.
We have... How farming machinery with giant labels on it showing people getting shredded. Why do we have to have labels? I'm one of those advocates that's like, just remove the warning labels and let Mother Nature take its course.
So drivers are then abusing technology.
Yeah.
Very much so.
That's what's effectively happening. The drivers are abusing the technology because videos have circulated showing drivers abusing systems, including the one that made the rounds last week, showing a driver apparently snoozing in a Tesla.
Oh, that's stupid.
While driving on the freeway in Los Angeles.
And then when he gets greased by an 18-wheeler, the family wants to sue Tesla for what? Because your idiot father was sleeping behind the wheel.
Well, that's how I want to go.
What?
Not screaming like the passengers.
Not screaming like the passengers. Peacefully asleep, not screaming like my passengers.
So just... understand the technology, because that's one of the things that we've established as part of the problem.
RTFM.
What does that mean?
Read the manual. But George, seriously, how many people actually do read the manuals?
No.
Most of us figure things out as we go along.
We're in a society of headline reading. We're in a society of headline reading, and we rather watch something on a screen or listen to it than actually read it, which is sad, but this is your life you're taking into your hands. Autopilot's not designed. No. None of these cars' technologies are designed for you to go and have a snooze. Damn it, man. Gee whiz.
People are still going to do it and post videos of it on YouTube.
Talking about posting videos on YouTube, you guys catch that video of that moron doing 322Ks on the R21 next to the airport?
Yes.
What a dumbass. I hope he's caught. Honestly, I hope he's caught.
I hope they find him and they crush that car. Yeah, I really do. I know. Because that just gives everybody
in performance cars a bad name. Hang on a second. That poor car doesn't deserve that treatment. They should crush the driver.
Take his license away from
him. All right, let's take that this boxing match offline. Very, very final story. And VW guarantees their EV battery capacity for 8 years or 100,000 miles. Now, I think this may be, some of the first guarantees coming to fruition. But is 100,000 miles or 8 years sufficient before you replace your battery? And what does it cost?
Well, it's still too early to really say because modern EVs haven't really been around that long. But BMW, in fact, also has a guarantee, 70%, at least 70% capacity for 8 years, 100,000 miles as well for their i3.
And Tesla's got something similar. And Tesla's batteries apparently have 90% capacity after 160,000 miles and may last for up to 500,000 miles.
Yes.
So, and everybody knows that Tesla's battery technology is leading the pack in terms of, the size of the battery. If you go and look up some of the technology or the techniques that they use to try and get the most out of their battery packs, you'd be surprised to learn that it's different to most other EV battery packs.
Does that include ludicrous mode?
Don't know.
Ludicrous mode mostly places thrown on the transmission.
Not on the batteries
or the inverters or anything else. That's the main thing. So what you're trying to tell me is I really should get written Tesla. Off Tesla and transplant all of that into my old Land Rover.
That's the way to go. So that's all we have time for, folks. And, it's been an awesome morning. And Martin, Lawrence, I hope you have a good week.
Yeah, thank you, George.
Thanks, George.
To you.
This is CliffCentral.com.